This is a volume of Paris Review, which isn't published any longer. I don't know when it went out of publication, but I think about 1965 or so.
Started again.
What went out?
Paris Review.
Oh, it started again now?
It's running right now.
Okay. But these old copies, this is from 1960, when Pasternak was still alive. If you're in the city, you can usually find in circulation rooms in the libraries. And many of the articles in them are very interesting. This one, which is volume 24, has an interview with Boris Pasternak conducted by a woman named Olga Carlisle, and also one with Robert Frost. And they made a point of having these interviews as part of their monthly, whatever it was, format. I think it was four times a year it came out. But anyway, this one, I wanted to read just a portion of what this interview consisted of, and then I'll leave this around so you can read it. She talks at great length about what Pasternak's house was like, which is interesting, his study, his estate in the country outside Moscow, etc. And she asks him the question, "Do you have any difficulty receiving your mail?" He says, "At present I receive all of it. Everything sent me, I assume. There's a lot of it, which I'm delighted to receive, though I'm troubled by the volume of it and the compulsion to answer all of it." Remember that Pasternak was not one of those people who the Russian officialdom was in love with. Right? He was persecuted during his lifetime, as most of the more outspoken authors are. "As you can imagine, some of the letters I get about Dr. Zhivago are quite absurd. Recently, somebody writing about Dr. Zhivago in France was inquiring about the plan of the novel. I guess it baffles the French sense of order. But how silly, for the plan of the novel is outlined by the poems accompanying it. This is partly why I choose to publish them alongside the novel. They are there also to give the novel more body, more richness. For the same reason, I used religious symbolism to give warmth to the book. Now, some critics have gotten so wrapped up in those symbols, which are put in the book the way stoves go into a house to warm it up, they would like me now to commit myself and climb into the stove. Have you read, now the next question, have you read Edmund Wilson's critical essays on Dr. Zhivago in The New Yorker and The New Republic? Yes, I've read them and appreciated their perception and intelligence, but you must realize that the novel must not be judged on theological lines. Nothing is further from my understanding of the world. One must live and write restlessly with the help of the new reserves that life offers. I am weary of this notion of faithfulness to the point of view at all costs. Life around us is ever changing, and I believe that one should try to change one's slant accordingly, at least once every 10 years. The great heroic devotion to one point of view is very alien to me. It's a lack of humility." That's the quote.
Okay, and Tom was asking, just be good for you to puzzle that out. Puzzle for it. Heroic devotion to one point of view is a lack of humility. I think that was the one that you were talking about at lunch, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
A lot else in that, what Pasternak says there to talk about, too. Mm-hmm.
The thing I'm curious about is, see, I've been in the process of, John and I have gone through arguments and arguments about this book for years. See, we've had long, long arguments at one point. And it's also mentions, he mentions Faulkner in here and his great love for him. And this was our original great argument about who should have won the Nobel Prize, Pasternak or Faulkner. And how do you see Dr. Zhivago? Is it a religious book? Do you see it in those terms? What is a religious novel?
What?
And the thing that you mentioned about it being about dogma, what do you see in the novel as anti-dogma or whatever?
I have just, well, the word related. Last night, Rich was talking about how he didn't think Christianity was a religion. And then this morning, you had the same thing talked about in Matins, about Christianity not being a religion. And so I'm really confused on now when you're using that word. Mm-hmm. And what meaning, what you're talking about when you're using, looking at the book religious.
Well, I mean, in sense of this book has often been called the greatest Christian novel of this century. America produces books like The Road, which every church library has 8 copies of, right? Do you see this as a Christian novel? What are its statements about Christianity?
I think one of the statements is that Christianity isn't a formula. No, it has no. You just kind of have to live life as it comes and decide at the time. You can't really decide ahead of time what you're going to do.
Wouldn't that, though, be a statement to say, in effect, that if that is so, what differentiates us then from dogs, for instance, who live life also from moment to moment? How are you confronted by Dr. Zhivago himself? What do you think of that man? Is he weak, ignorant, ineffectual, unable to make choices? What is appealing in him to you?
Is he a hero?
Yeah.
Is he the hero of the book?
Would that depend too, what you would mean by hero? A lot would depend.
Is he heroic? Is he? Laudable. Is he a great man? He does. It's good to talk with him. Is he a great man? Is he a good man? Is he, you know, all sorts of things. The book does throw a wrench into those kinds of categories, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Do you think he'll ever forget him?
He had his own idea of kind of philosophy, and he would always state that, like when he was working in that hospital in Murrieta, and he never. He stated what he felt or what he knew or what he liked to be near. I can't remember exactly what he said or anything.
If you had to list some things or some things after reading the book that you feel, this is what Zhivago feels about love, relationships, freedom, etc. What would you say? If you had to condense that, in other words, what exactly is it that he says life is, for instance, or doesn't he say?
I'm not quite all the way through the book yet, but he sure, in 139, in the first paragraph on 39, that was just a beautiful paragraph. I really enjoyed it. And as I said, I can't say if it's the greatest religious book the time yet, because I haven't made it all the way through yet. But this would, at the stage I am in, I would lean towards that from just that one paragraph.
Which paragraph? What is it, sir?
The top paragraph.
When he says, "Let me tell you what I think," it's on the top of 39.
Okay, that's the with Caligula at the bottom.
It's on page 39.
As far as you are,
Barbara? No, I'm
started in
page 39.
Yeah. Where is the huge, deliberately provincial?
What did you ask John Mike over?
Yeah, there's a passage with where the Galilean deliberately provincial.
On page 40.
Why don't you read that, Tommy? Read that when you want.
Okay. Rome was a flea market of borrowed gods and conquered peoples, a bargain basement on two floors, earth and heaven, a mass of filth convoluted into a triple knot, as in an intestinal obstruction. Dacians, Herulians, Scythians, Sarmatians, Hyperboreans, heavy wheels without spokes, eyes sunk in fat, sodomy, double chins, illiterate emperors, fish fed on the flesh of learned slaves. There were more people in the world than there have ever been since, all crammed into the passages of the Colosseum, and all wretched. And then into this tasteless heap of gold and marble, he came, light and clothed in an aura, emphatically human, deliberately provincial, Galilean, and at that moment gods and nations ceased to be, and man came into being, man the carpenter, man the plowman, man the shepherd with his flock of sheep at sunset, man who does not sound in the least proud, man thankfully celebrated in all the cradle songs of mothers and in all the picture galleries the world over.
Was that put in there like a stove to warm it up?
Where was that interview done?
On his estate in Russia.
In Russia. I trust that she's not a Russian.
She is.
She is.
Yeah. How do you see the ideas that are in there carried through in the book? Are they? Or is this just his uncle's religious? Remember, he's a defrocked priest, right? Familiar with theology and religion.
Which it is preached to console the weak is alien to me. I have always understood Christ's words about the living and the dead in a different sense.
Where could you find room for all these hordes of people accumulated over thousands of years? The universe isn't big enough for them. God, the good, meaningful purpose would be crowded out. They'd be crushed by these throngs, greedy, nearly the end of life. Something that always has stuck in my mind is the paragraph, second or third paragraph down, where it says, will you feel no pain? Do the tissues feel their disintegration? In other words, what will happen to your consciousness? What is consciousness? Let's see. A conscious attempt to fall asleep is sure to produce insomnia. To try to be conscious of one's own digestion is a sure way to upset the stomach. Consciousness is a poison when we apply it to ourselves. Consciousness is a light directed outward. It lights up the way ahead of us so that we don't stumble. It's like the headlights on a locomotive. Turn them inward and you'd have a crash. I've always really liked that. I've been able to apply that to me because I look at myself. Crash.
What do you make of what comes after that in the next paragraph? You and others, this is your soul, this is what you are. This is what your consciousness has breathed and lived on and enjoyed throughout your life. Your soul, your immortality, your life in others. And what now? You have always been in others and you will remain in others. And what does it matter to you if later on that is called your memory? This will be you. The you that enters the future and becomes a part of it. And then below that, and talent in the highest and broadest sense means talent for life.
What we need is something new, and that new thing is life eternal. You kind of overall view of life, not just one little thing that matters so much, but the whole time.
How many have finished the book? About half? Half the people? You got one? About half? Can't see all the pages, but all the end. Two. Makes it really hard to talk. We don't have a sample. Those that have read it, how many felt that did anyone feel that it was a great book, a great novel?
I liked it.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why? Let's start from that. Mm-hmm. Get it going, and then we'll get back to some of these questions. I'm going to fall asleep if we don't.
I don't know, I guess just. Well, I enjoyed it just as a novel, you know, just the enjoyment for reading. But I got a lot of folded over pages too, that part. So I just, what he talked about life and referred to different things and some of the things that he said, you know, I just really thought they were quite good. And when we were doing Brothers Karamazov, you know, you mentioned something about placing ourselves, you know, in the book. And just the life situation that he was going through was just, wow. I've never met someone like that person, you know, as far as that. And what we were just talking about, as far as what he was, that was Yuri who was talking, the quotes that you read. I was wondering, did he, towards the end, lose most of these
feelings and stuff. As far as when Laurel left the house, the last time they broke away from each other, that's a question I had. Did he lose his any faith that he would have had, or did he have faith? You know?
There's a big change in him, wasn't there? When he went to the outskirts of Moscow, and they had gone to see him, blending in with, you know, his individuality was gone. And all of a sudden, Zhivago, who could stand out in the crowd all through the, you know, you get the sense that he'd stand out a little bit in any situation, just blends into the old rag, you know, into the rag, goes to see, and he uses that word himself on that. Goes to see, does he stay there? What was your response when he says, what was your response when he's on the outskirts of Moscow? Did this book, did Zhivago make you mad? Did you get angry? And that, well, our argument, didn't it start on that point? I was really furious at Zhivago.
Myself.
Just furious at him. And then I said, Gupta, I said that. Tom says, I think the book should have gotten 2 Nobel Prizes. What? And right now I think 3. You know, Tom has decided that it doesn't even deserve a Pulitzer. No,
I don't say that. One is plenty.
One is plenty.
I think that's an important, I think that's maybe the easiest way to start in terms to is, how do you see this guy? You know, what are his redeeming qualities to you? I mean, I cried at the end of this book the first time I read it. Why?
Yeah.
Why? What is the basis of the attachment with this person?
Well, in the beginning, I, you know, he had so many good things to say, and I really just, you know, soaking in all of this, you know, really fun stuff. In the end, I cried because of place. I was grieving for life that didn't seem to be very much. You know? That he was just, you know, kind of gone. And an attachment would be that he's really he's made because of being created, he's made more than what he is. Like, I was an attachment with that.
What do you mean? Did you say it to me? But I was angry, and he says, but John, you wanted to make Zhivago a hero, and Pasternak wouldn't let you. And when I wanted to make him a hero, and then it didn't work, I blamed Pasternak, and I said it was a punk book. Tom reminds me, but John, that's what you wanted. I wanted that sucker to have a, you know, happy end. I mean, I lived, you know, was living that thing, and then there he is in Moscow, you know, walking in there. Come on, you know, cheer, you know. I just got, my bottom fell out. I can remember the place I was when I was reading. But a book that makes you throw it against the wall when you're done with it doesn't say that isn't a bad book. Necessarily. not going to step on it.
Was that the argument? You wanted
We went around. On that, but basically, I felt he muffled. I mean, he muffed his character. But in a sense, I was trying to make a Russian novel out of it, in which there's, you can probably, well, there's ambiguity in Dostoevsky, but I wanted him to be something that was not ambiguous. Tom, you want to speak to that? I mean, where book moves you like this? What you want, or do you want to talk some more about it right now?
I was really disappointed. Yeah, in that sense, the same as, I don't know if I wanted it to be a hero, but I guess maybe I did. You know, but I'm not sure that I would have said that. And just the, you know, maybe or an identity with life that does life justice, even, you know, not necessarily heroic, but want to see, has all of this good stuff, you know, and then he kind of loses it. He doesn't remain faithful. He kind of, and you get the idea that he's, you know, drifting to the situation and maybe changing with the spirit of the times or something, you know, maybe that's what Pasternak is saying about it. But boy, I don't know.
I think you can think of the book in terms of an overall idea of how that is in any book that's good, and that's how do you keep your integrity as a man or a woman in the 20th century. That's definitely a question of this book. Throughout it, there's all these things about what the political powers may do to you, what the social pressures may do to you, and you end up with the kind of thing you were saying, like on page 249, where he says it's only in mediocre books that people are divided into two camps and have nothing to do with each other. In real life, everything gets mixed up. Don't you think you'd have to be a hopeless non-entity to play one role all your life, to have only one place in society, always to stand for the same thing? Ah, there you are. This is the kind of thing he's always talking about. Remember what the meaning of his name in Russian is, Dr. Life. Shivago is Russian for life. Or whatever clues you may want to draw from that. But you get this same idea over and over again. Reshaping life. People who can say that have never understood a thing about life. They have never felt its breath, its heartbeat. However much they have seen or done, they look on it as a lump of raw material that needs to be processed by them to be ennobled by their touch. But life is never a material, a substance to be molded. If you want to know, life is a principle of self-renewal. It is constantly renewing and remaking and changing and transfiguring itself. It is infinitely beyond your or my obtuse theories about it.
In Russian, if you wrote that in Russian, where life came in, would you say Shivago?
A form of it, a closed form
of
it.
So you'd be talking about whenever you just use the Shivago where it says life in that passage that you just read.
Reshaping Shivago. People who can say that have never understood a thing about Shivago.
Go on. Say some more.
They have never felt it, his breath or his heartbeat, however much they have seen or done. They look on him as a lump of raw material that needs to be processed by them to be ennobled by their touch. But Shivago is never a material, a substance to be molded. If you want to know, Shivago is the principle of self-renewal. He is constantly renewing and remaking and changing and transfiguring himself. He is infinitely beyond your or my obtuse theories about him.
What page is that?
282. And you really have oftentimes a split in the book between what Shivago says and what Shivago does. When he's postulating on the meaning of life, we very quickly go, yeah, I'm for the gospel too. I like that idea. But the problem is always, what do you do with it? Right? Mm-hmm. This is the thing that Solzhenitsyn is so clear on. He says, oh, sure, we all want to stand up for freedom, don't we? But for freedom, you sit down in jail. Mm-hmm. It's not a stand-up affair. See, stand up and be counted, sit down and have the shackles put on. You know? And there's the overtones of that in here too. Or the same kind of thing you see on page 336, where he says, it was then that untruth came into our land of Russia. The main misfortune, and this is terribly contemporary, the root, and exactly what you were talking about yesterday in terms of Dante, the root of all the evil to come was the loss of confidence in the value of one's own opinion. People imagined that it was out of date to follow their own moral sense, that they must all sing in chorus and live by other people's notions that were being crammed down everybody's throat. And then there arose the power of the glittering phrase, first the czarist, then the revolutionary. This social evil became an epidemic. It was catching and it affected everything. Nothing was left untouched by it. Our home too became infected. Something went wrong in it. Instead of being natural and spontaneous as it had always been, we began to be idiotically pompous with each other. Showy artificial force crept into our conversation, right? And this is Laura explaining why Pasha Antipov goes off and, you know, turns himself into Strelnikov. And in terms of that, how do you see him? Is Strelnikov sympathetic to you? Mm-hmm. Take a man. Kurt, what do you think of him? You've read it. Sympathetic to him? Like him? Hate him? How many have seen the film?
Pity.
Yeah.
Pity.
What's pitiful in Strelnikov?
That he was just so moved by all this dogma and these words, and that he didn't come out of him, the individual, but from the outside it sort of molded him into this thing.
Mm-hmm. What does he get molded into?
Power instead of love. Mm-hmm. Didn't seem to have any emotion. It was just more kind of a mechanic kind of thing.
Yeah, it was the military expert who wasn't even a member of the party.
And your mind can become like that, I think, if you don't have a combination of emotion and with it.
It's like
if you just think for thinking, it becomes all intellect and no feeling. You have to combine it.
Mm-hmm. It's like his personage became more important to himself than his person.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain that more?
Well, he just threw himself so much into this power thing instead of love, you know, and into his work and stuff. You know, he completely ignored, if he had any feelings for his family or anything, ignored.
Towards the end, though, he really wanted to get rid of that personage, I thought. He wanted to, you know, be the person. The way that he was talking to Yuri, mm-hmm. the house, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is finally lowering himself down, and not worry what other people were thinking of him.
Did he worry much about that?
I don't think he did, but...
I don't think he worried
what people thought of him, but he finally came out with some feelings, I thought, towards the end.
Yeah, he did, but he had feelings at times. What does Laura say that Pasha's doing on the next page from what Tom wrote?
334.
Oh, you want 333?
No, 336.
336 would be 337. She says Pasha is doing what?
What foolish things this childish nonsense made him do?
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Took offense at things at which one doesn't take offense.
That isn't the one I was thinking of.
Sulked at the course of events, he quarreled with history.
He what? Quarreled?
Quarreled with history. To this day he is trying to get even with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Getting even with history? Buy that? And is Laura... Is Laura somebody that we listen to, as if she has some good eyes, good judgment about what's happening in this case?
Yeah, she, isn't she the one that's always saying, what do you think? She says something and says, well, what do you think? It destroyed that a little bit for me.
Yeah.
I didn't think she was resolute at all in what she was thinking. So I questioned whether...
But how well did she handle herself on 336? She does say, what do you think? What do you think?
I think that can be like saying, you know.
Well, this is a different thing.
Or maybe, does she really want to know?
Well, like, she wanted to be told, but nobody was, so she was trying to fill it in. And kind of bring other people out to tell her.
What she's talking about is his Pasha's response to what's going on, and it would seem to be there, you know, there would be a couple of different responses, and he's looking at the falseness of that's crept into the relationship, that's crept into his life, and he chooses to do this. He chooses to run away, and he chooses to, if she's right, choose a life that, you know, that is trying to get even with that instead of dealing with the problem where it's at, mm-hmm. with himself, with the falseness, and taking some stand against having that stuff influence him.
Did you get the feeling that Pasha really cared which side he was on toward the end?
Mm-mm.
Was he in that upper room?
At the beginning, I felt that way, but toward the end, I just lost it. You know, I got a question on that, getting even with history. At times, is Zhivago doing that, getting even with history?
By retaining the old, by the old order, or thinking back upon it.
In the book, the Russian Revolution isn't the glorious victory that I suppose the Soviet Union would like people to think of it as. More of a disruption and a destructive force in life. Like, he would have been all right if it hadn't been for the revolution.
Yeah, he would have been all right. If
mm-hmm.
he wouldn't have been.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the... Revolution is one of the main characters in here. It's like, Tom, what you say about Russian novels, that main character of every Russian novel is Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And
here that's been denied him in this picking of this particular time, in a sense. I feel now, which I didn't feel before. This is one of the big questions in the novel that they go over so many times, where he talks about them being the new Adam and Eve, even. Everything, here we are stark naked. We have nothing left. We have no homes. We have barely clothes. You have these long scenes of Zhivago out in the wilderness trying to find himself someplace. You know, where, when the whole society falls apart, do your values go? And then you have these characters who end up, like on 334, where Lara talks about Strelnikov in this way. It was as if something abstract had crept into his face and made it colorless. This is really great description. As if a living human face had become the embodiment of a principle. The image of an idea. My heart sank when I noticed it. I realized that this had happened to him because he had handed himself over to a superior force, but a force that is deadening and pitiless and will not spare him in the end. It seemed to me that he was a marked man and that this was the seal of his doom. But perhaps I was confused about it. Perhaps some influence with what you said when you described your meeting to him. After all, in addition to what we feel for each other, I'm influenced by you in so many ways. And that thing about being homeless on the next page. It isn't a matter of individuals, of being alike or different in temperament, of loving or not loving. All customs and traditions, all our way of life, everything to do with home and order is crumbled into dust in the general upheaval and reorganization of society. The whole human way of life has been destroyed and ruined. All that's left is the naked human soul, stripped to the last shred, for which nothing has changed, because it has always been cold and shivering and reaching out to its nearest neighbor, as cold and lonely as itself. So he mentions in this article that one of his purposes in writing the book is to capture what he felt were some of the best moments of this whole revolutionary period. Remember, as far as historical significance goes in this, the 1905 was the first large revolution in Russia, followed by one in 1907, one in 1911, and then finally the one in 1917, which this book largely deals with, which was brought about largely by the First World War. But when this whole question was, you know, Marxism is science, life is shaped, the new gods.
I don't understand why. In the end, he talks about he did it all for Laura. You know, she's the indictment of a new age. Boy, I don't understand that at all.
What page is that on?
384.
Oh, the fellow that...
Mm-hmm. What do you associate Laura with? What is Laura to Shivago? What does she supply him that he doesn't have? What binds them together?
She's considering the future a lot, isn't she? And he's...
All the themes of the century. Well, in this paragraph it says that something about when she was younger, you could see in her eyes that it was all the themes of the century, kind of age.
She says to him one time that she as a woman is anchored to the ground while he can soar, but I don't think he could soar without her. You know, it's the other way around. He relates her a lot to springtime. He talks about her in relation to springtime.
It says here too, the resentment, the accumulation of resentment and pride were written in the face and bearing. With both shyness and self-assured grace. Kind of both sides, kind of accumulation of everything.
Is Laura the heroine then of this book, as opposed to Shivago being the hero? She does say at one point, you and I, talking to Shivago, don't really think alike. When it comes to the intangible, the marginal choices, we understand each other. But when it comes to the big issues, to one's outlook on life, we don't see eye to eye. What are they to each other?
For that matter, none of us see the same. None of us really agree on everything. And which will help us to form what we think of the thing that we're thinking of. Everything that we know will help us to decide.
Well, let's take then the character that puts the two of them together. who is who? Who introduces Shivago to Lara? How do they get to know each other?
Komarovsky.
What are your feelings for Komarovsky? What is he?
A womanizer.
Right. A womanizer. Notice that Komarovsky is always portrayed with his bulldogs, right? Telling dirty jokes. And then kicking the dogs.
Dr. Zhivago's father when he died.
Seems he brought madness on his father and madness to the doctor.
Kind of pressured him. Mm-hmm. He seemed like kind of a pressured person.
Didn't he try to justify himself that he was helping his father too?
When he said his father died in his arms.
Yeah, when he already had another way of hearing how his father died. I'm confused where the epilogue comes in. It was good, but if someone could briefly explain some of the things in there, in general. I'm not exactly sure what was going on and why he put it in and stuff.
Thing is that if you can answer each other's questions rather than...
I've seen the movie and I think it's that they're found Zhivago and Laura's daughter. Is that right?
They suppose.
They suppose they
is
suppose.
Is that Laura's daughter?
I think so, because remember when... And I'm okay about the lady in purple too, walking along the street when he's in the train at the end of the book.
In the movie,
is that Laura?
No.
In the movie, they show it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's where it missed. I didn't think it was, but I'm not really sure where she fits in here. Oh, I guess maybe he just started.
He has this thing about her walking along the train and him going
and
through
the train goes. Yeah. Okay,
and
that's
she's,
just
she succeeds him as far as.
I think Laura, at one time too, doesn't she try to find out if she could find an orphan, if it's possible to find an orphan or a child that is home, a homeless child?
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I've kind of got confused a little bit there too, but I just...
I have another question then. Just before the epilogue, in that page before, what was the important fact then that she told... What's his name? Because just when she was at the casket, wasn't she wanted to tell Yuri something, but she couldn't bring herself to telling him at the farewell speech too. It seems like she was always holding herself back of telling him something as she was talking to him at the casket. Maybe it's my imagination.
Yeah, that connects in with the child.
Yeah.
Oh, does it? Oh,
yeah, earlier in the book, too, she said that she wanted to tell him something.
And that's why. That was when we were out in the country again, and she wants to tell him something, and he already suspects it to be pregnancy, but yet somehow we're led to think that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? But she did have.
Oh,
okay.
Or Valsey's doubt. She probably had already had the child and given it away, maybe, whereas he thought that she wanted to get pregnant there or after that or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe was pregnant at the time. That's how I thought of it.
Okay.
I thought that she was pregnant.
I didn't think that.
And that last epilogue too functions in the framework of the novel to tie in the idea at the beginning that it's your life and others that keeps you alive. And what is the last sentence? In the book they held seemed to confirm and encourage her feeling. It's a very important idea inside this book.
What did you say? What was it? That what keeps you together?
That he's in the epilogue too, thematically, he's tying up the idea that your life in others is what you really are.
Okay.
That even the memory of Shivago is something that remains, something that keeps.
Wow.
Yeah. That life goes on through that.
But then the way that he says about Laura's probably death or probable end, you know, is just before the epilogue when he says that, and she probably lived in, you know, a certain place for some long amount of time, and, you know, and somehow she became a number or something like that, and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just, you know, that's a contradiction.
Yeah, this is how he drops her, huh?
Yeah.
Drops her right off the edge of the world.
Yeah.
Forgotten as a nameless number on a list that afterwards got mislaid in one of the innumerable mixed or women's concentration camps in the north.
Yeah.
She kind of like served a purpose and then just kind of faded out.
See, this whole thing about depersonalization runs all through this book.
Yeah.
See, one of the things that makes this novel so very difficult is the number and the amount of themes with which Pasternak's going to deal. It's biographical, first of all. It deals with an author writing about a make-believe author whose own poetry is stuck in on the end. Right? So you have, in a sense, two, three books in one. It's historical. Right? It's a love story. Philosophical. All of these considerations on modern art. Right? On the intricacies of playing Chopin on the piano. The Christian themes, the nature themes, the Russian themes, it's a small geography in itself.
Mm-hmm.
What isn't in it? Very little. And that's one of the themes that's given you on the first page of it. On they go, singing Rest Eternal, and you have this idea that's carried along at the funeral. Who's dead? Shivago. Oh, I see. That's what it is. It's not him. It's his wife. Well, it comes the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh. See, you begin to tie these themes. It's very carefully drawn. And you look at the pages. Look at just the 5 o'clock express, this train that runs all through this book. Where does he die? On the train. Where does his father die? What do they hear at the funeral? Trains. Where do they get to the Urals by? What is it you don't turn inwards? Like the lights of a locomotive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do they meet the kid who's trying to escape? Where does Strelnikov live? On the train. That which has no place where it stops, but momentarily. Right. Remember the image of the staircase, if you've read Crime and Punishment. Where does Raskolnikov make all his decisions? On the stairs. In the middle of the stairs, not up or down. And you have, so it is rich in these symbols. You start to connect these symbols together, you know, and a lot of ideas start coming through. You start looking at the way the chapters are, even in part one, arranged. You have the burial, death. The second one, it deals with nature. The third one deals with history. The fourth one is political. The fifth one is religious.
No. And then the sixth one puts forward the idea that there is no theory apart from its practice. Right? See, because what happens there? You know, he says, nothing terrible would happen if he failed to pray for his father that day. What happens to his father that day? Yeah.
What he said the other day about prayer, too, that all over the world people praying could be maybe holding the world together. Like our intercession here, maybe somebody praying at night someplace else on the earth. All this prayer around the world just holding it together. That's the only thing that holds it together. Mm-hmm. Another thing, too, when you said, okay, that guy that made his decisions on the stairs, he was kind of in the middle of going somewhere. And he wasn't there at his destination, he was on the way. It's like this train concept. One thing that kind of came to my mind is Rich Cameron always says, art is in the making, not after it's made. It's in the making. It's the art of a piece that he does is while he's making it, not the finished product. Like life too, art and life
could
be, you know, our life while we're living it.
One thing said in this book is art is the continuation of the Gospel of St. John. What does that mean? Art is the continuation of the Gospel of St. John.
Is that your words, or is that in here? Or?
That's in there.
One thing I just looked at here, where I just turned to it, it says, and talent in the highest and broadest sense means talent for life. Talent.
You
think of talent
in
art.
Did Zhivago have it?
Maybe not, because no theory apart from practice. There's theory apart from practice. It seemed like he knew a lot about life, but then when it came right down to living it the way he knew it,
quoting Tom from last year, Laura provides something for Zhivago that he dies for the lack of in the end.
Can you repeat that?
Laura provides something for Zhivago that he dies of, that he dies for the lack of in the end.
Zhivago is the word life, that we each provide something for life, or else it dies. So to live life to the best, or to live life not just dwindling, or not just kind of, but really life, you know, a zest for life, or a zealous life, or I think that's important, not just to kind of let everybody mold and shape you, but to have some good ideas of your own, to let them be known.
To be, to real interesting, you know, life.
Use your mind.
Zhivago, go after it. Zhivago, the poet, the doctor, the sort of this Renaissance fellow, He stands for life. And don't let just things mold you, you know.
Do you think Laura molded him, though?
Not in that somebody just, you know, squeezes you and says,
he molded but his life.
Well, they talked. They spoke to one another their ideas and he had somebody to talk to. But then when it comes out, he's living like this.
Is Zhivago who he is because of who he's with? And does he change when he's with somebody else? Does he shift?
What happens to him in Moscow about love?
Or is it Laura? You know, I turn it over, but I don't have him. I don't know what it says. But, or is that just a... You know, because he certainly had something before Laura, but and then is she just there?
What did he have then?
I don't know about who, you know. That's why I don't know if it is a who, you know. But and then he certainly needed somebody, but yet like at the end of his third, so to speak, marriage or whatever. That you know, always having somebody there, but not somebody who had a strong influence or whatever. But you know, was she that influence, or was she just there, happened to be there at that time in his life? I don't know.
And I remember too, like in the beginning of the book, where he and Tanya grew up in the same house, and they just got married. He just kind of ran with the tie or whatever. He didn't really seem like he got very easily molded into that. He didn't rebel at all. Seems like.
That would be a question I have. Is it Laura? Is it a person?
Because when we see him without people, he's out in the middle of the tundra in winter. All by himself.
Or is that circumstance?
Well, it is a circumstance, but then in terms of the novel, we see him. We see him. This is one of the things that, when I first read this, scared the liver out of me in terms of my own person. I've thought sometimes that my own life, very much according to whom I'm with, that if the situation demands something of me, then I might be able to come up with something. If it doesn't, you know, there's a kind of a washing away of other people bring out individuality in me. And other people go away. You know, I used to. It isn't so much now, but you know, I used to. When the other people would go away, I would be a sort of a blank. Okay, now what? Just sit. And somebody comes along and demands poetry, and there's a poem. You don't want to ask me to write, so I don't. Somebody asks me to write a poem. But somebody's got to ask me to write. You know, but outside of that, I'm sitting there like a wall. And that's in the old days. And then the feeling that Zhivago never had a father, and that in a sense there could be a difficulty there in his ever becoming, you know, a man. Wasn't he raised by women, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
He's got
his uncle.
His uncle, uncle is always off to Switzerland.
Off somewhere else.
His mother for the first 10 years. She died when he was 10.
Yeah. And for him, life in Russia was like life in America. Now for us, this is in a greenhouse in a sense that you just walk through your paces. Mm-hmm. happen. Going along, something this doesn't connect really with this, but something that popped in my mind right now, that Strelnikov didn't think he was good enough for Lara, and in a sense, Zhivago didn't think he was good enough for Tonya, and it kept them from their persons from meeting, because you can't. Zhivago had a real difficult time having a confessional life with Tonya, because of thinking that she's just a thing. Somehow Lara could be more, you know, without preaching, could be more a gospel in terms of releasing him, because she had a history, see.
Mm-hmm. I remember, John, that you told me once before that sometimes thinking that you're not good enough is just as bad or maybe worse than thinking you're too good for something.
Yes.
You go on the same.
Yeah.
The same conceits of same type of conceit.
Yeah, it is. I think you're worse. You think you're more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Is both.
Instead of just realizing that you're different and you shouldn't compare yourself like that.
So that's, you know, that has quite a bit to say with why he never takes advantage of the obvious opportunities to go back
to
Tonya.
Because
he could have gone back at the time when it was the Karmowski or whoever he is.
Offered
for both of them to go back, you know. And that's when I couldn't understand that.
One of the crazy things is I can sit there and I can cheer this guy on all the way through the thing, and then I realize at the end he's got three wives all living, and he's got how many, five kids or three kids?
I don't remember the number, but
all deserted. Wait a minute.
And each one deserted with the idea, I mean, why does he desert the last one? I'm going to make it. I'm going to go get reshaped. Just give me a little time away. He really is a disappointment.
Yeah. Did he make up? Did his mind, you know, did he intellectually come back? He was just praising the mechanical, you know, aspects of the revolution and everything, and how what an improvement everything was in terms of the Russia and everything. Just prior to his death, you know, he was doing this, writing some stuff on this, and. He dies in a trolley that has the windows hammered shut, which is passed by the woman in purple 10 times, you know, during traffic. You know, and he intellectually has just been praising this advancement, and the trolleys are running on time kind of thing of the revolution. And this purple woman in purple walking passes him all these times. And Lara is seen as heir, you know. In lots of the scenes when Lara comes in, its windows go open, you know, and then he dies of suffocation at the end, you know, that he can't get this thing open.
And thirst, in a sense, the dryness of that passage. Lara is always associated with water.
Oh boy, she's
everywhere. The snow melts when Lara appears.
Yeah.
Just, woof, springtime, you know. He breathes. You know. What is their life like at Varikino? You know? Right, one time he bursts
cleaning
into prayer.
Cleaning the water pan out of that first
thing. Here's another teary, you know, farewell my great one. She's talking about him. Farewell my great one, my own. Farewell my pride. Farewell my swift deep river. How I loved your day long splashing. How I loved to plunge into your cold waves. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Eat your heart out, novel lovers. Oh, damn. This thing is filled with deep.
One thing that really struck me was about Lauren Yuri was just how he looked at her as almost like a god. That's how I, you know, pictured Laurel. And when she left, you know, just everything caved in. And that just, you know, I was thinking of how we really can't have individuals in our lives, you know, turn them into gods, you know, because we're left with nothing, you know, like if they leave or walk out on us.
Yeah.
And the importance of
centering our lives around Christ, you know, rather than on different individuals. And that was really...
And then how do you, you know... Okay. Let's say... Yeah. Is this a... You know, you could say this is a Christian novel. You know, I think every Greek novel is a Christian novel. I'll claim them all. It's sort of like going out and sticking a flag in your hand and this book. But... But we're... Can you talk of Laura and Dr. Zhivago as Christians? Adam and Eve Christians. What would happen if Adam and Eve were dropped down in the middle of the Russian Revolution?
They'd be confused.
Just be getting freezed to death.
What did you say?
Yeah. Oh gosh. I can't answer that.
And that's exactly what he calls those two. The Adam and Eve. That's an interesting question. Would they be? In what sense would they be Christians? Because one of the things we see in the novel is that a lot of our basis of judging whether someone is Christian or not, a lot of times comes on just how headlong, or how head-on they come against some problem. You know, where we can see, at this point, character A moved from place one to place two, and made that choice, which is the Christian choice, as opposed to this one, which is the unchristian choice. He's in this camp, and we make a little check there. And the problem about living that this book is so clear on is that nothing comes against you head on. Try putting your head against something head on at the university someday. Now, you'll be very lucky if you have a head-on confrontation. Things, you know, go around you. Now, this is what that one point in the book where he says, how does life get you? How does it wear you down? By lightning and thunder? No, by whispered calumny and lies and slander. Isn't that the way it is, right? Same thing with, you know, just something that occurred to me last year, leaving Holden Village. Here I'm, you know, beefed up for the gospel, you know, ready for the pilgrimage. Off I go, march down the bus, boom, down the road, onto the boat. Who are these creeps around this book? You know, see? Lost right there. The first battle. Right? That's lose out. Ah, good. You know, devil says, ha ha, good old Tom. Yeah? Good old Tom I know and love. This is the thing in this book, see? You try to put your finger on this guy. And wait a minute now. What happens to him? What's the first line in Dante from yesterday? Midway upon this journey, life of ours, I found myself in a wood unknown how I came unto that robust and rough the place. And all of a sudden you see Zhivago, he's over here, and then we don't even really question, he's over here now. Oh, wait a minute now. And then, like John said, what? This guy's got three wives. Suddenly comes in. And I go, wait a minute. He is disappointing in that way, in the sense that the thing that I connect strongly with Christianity, at least in Russian novel terms, is the idea of freedom. And you have this quote here, something in the world had changed. This is with the coming of Christianity. Rome was at an end. The reign of numbers was at an end. The duty imposed by armed force to live unanimously as a people. See? This is the big thing of the revolution.
as a whole nation was abolished. Leaders and nations were relegated to the past. They were replaced by the doctrine of individuality and freedom. Individual human life became the life story of God, and its contents filled the past expanses of the universe. As it says in a liturgy for the Feast of the Annunciation, Adam tried to be like God and failed, but now God was made man so that Adam should be made God. That's on page 343. And above that, now on the basis of life is to be that inspiration which the gospel strives to make the foundation of life, contrasting the commonplace with the unique, the weekday with the holiday, and repudiating all compulsion. I mean, does Zhivago actually deny the power of revolution over him, or does he just by some dumb, fated luck slither away from the grasp of these people at the right time? Remember when he comes back to Moscow and all the disappointing types of things that have happened? The difference in terminology, right? You don't call your house your home anymore. It's living space. See? Remember that? Just these little nicks. See? We don't take these big chunks. The same way the devil, you know, has the supreme intelligence never to tempt us with anything large. And here you have a book where the guy isn't, in a sense, tempted with anything large. You know? I mean, if the devil came up to you with, you know, a woman with six mutilated babies crawling all over her body asking you for help in front of Koinonia, might you do something? You know? I mean, you would say, oh, I'm going to help. Gee. Well, I'm not like that guy. You know, I didn't pass the creep on the road, you know, the guy who was hurt in the road in the parable story. You know, I stopped and helped. You know? Well, the devil never gives you things like that. It's the guy on the boat.
See? Yeah.
It's those things. Not the lightning and thunder. No. And so you have this character in the middle of all this lightning and thunder. The world is coming apart here. No. Which they're very clear on. I mean, here you have these situations that you had in the time, which in the town what they're at, in the opposite the House of Sculptures, I forget the name of it, where at one time you have the White Russian army in there, and they kill off the Red supporters. And the Red supporters come in and kill off all the White Russian army. Then you do the same thing 8 or 9 times. And through this they come, you know, alive. Other people come out alive too. Who? Who's alive at the end? Who doesn't this book kill off? Komarovsky. See? He's made it. And successful. Money. And that is one of the themes of the book. You have that kind of choice. Do you want to exist or do you want to survive?
What's your distinction?
What? How would you distinguish?
Being alive and having a living.
How does Zhivago come through this? Is he changed? Would you say, here we have Dr. Zhivago, what is his specialty? A diagnostician, right? An important little comment, someone who can see disease. The young doctor, okay? Dr. Zhivago at the end. Other than being physically, you know, a wreck, is he a different man? Because, you know, what do they say? The tree that is buffeted about by the worst winds has the most character, right? Mm-hmm. Been through the great storms of life. These things are the moments in which you grow. Has he grown? Or is that an irrelevant question? I mean, it's one you have to ask, you know. You go through a lifetime like this, something happens. What happens?
One thing to think in this is, okay, to know that Dr. Zhivago goes to sea, and then what did the did Karamazov start with? It goes to seed, but unless some, you know, unless seed falls in the ground and dies, it cannot be born, have everlasting life. I mean, there is a kind of a death. Is there any kind of resurrection? If there is a resurrection, is it a resurrection of someone who is strong or someone who is weak? I mean, I can get angry because resurrection doesn't mean I become anybody but John. Christ comes into my life and I'm still John Brock. One, in a novel, somehow you think that if a person has, you know, if Christ did start to, you know, if Zhivago became a Christian, then it would, a great difference would be made in his life. Is that necessarily the way things happen? I mean, could he have gone around going, you know, writing dumb poems, writing dumb essays, and he's had a resurrection at the end? Did he get in under the wire?
And think in light of that too, of the crime and punishment. Oh, what happens to Raskolnikov? I mean, he has repented, but we can't accept it. Even in the epilogue, he's sitting in prison, right? Is he a new made man? Hallelujah.
Well, getting in under the wire,
that's a, you know, the about the laborer who comes at the last hour.
Why are these paid so much? Yeah.
You know, and then the guy that comes, you know, 5 minutes before quitting time, shows up at the vineyard and
gets the same amount of pay.
Gets the same amount of pay, goes to heaven. If the word becomes flesh, you know, the art is the continuation of the Gospel of John. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. You start from that point and you get the story of the word becoming flesh and dwelling among us. The word becoming, a word, an abstract word, a word like, well, do abstractions become concrete? Do the words, the big words, immortality become concrete at the end, by the end of the book? Is there a movement in Dr. Zhivago? Is there a filling of the word? Does immortality become resurrection? Instead of immortality as a memory?
He says on 16, I don't know, it just came to me though, he said, you were anxious about whether you will rise from the dead or not, but you rose from the dead when you were born and you didn't notice it. Now if you really truly...
Say that again.
You are anxious about whether you will rise from the dead or not, but you rose from the dead when you were born and you didn't notice it. So if he held that true.
That's the beginning of the book?
16.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is his lecture to the...
To the dying
mother.
Anna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot happens.
Yeah, there too you have this, the same kind of thing you have in several other places of Zhivago saying, I believe all these things. Then you have the actual prose of Zhivago song.
He also has the voice of Satan and Adam at the same time in one passage. I can't remember where that one is, but you know, right, it's around that section in, somewhere around there where he gets up and he says he's going to go out and deem everything. Mm-hmm. It's, I can't remember where it is, but he speaks with a satanic pride that is incredible. At the same time, he's talking, you know, he's, you can take that passage another way, and it's an Adam speech. He's going out to name everything. Mm-hmm. But there was no question in his mind that he could name everything correctly. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I guess in Oedipus, Tiresias leads, a little boy leads Tiresias, the blind prophet, or blind seer, into the city. And then here's the boy leading Trivago, and he's into the city at the end, and he's speechless. What happens to the man's voice? But boy, at the beginning, there's this beautiful passage to read. You know, the first response to it is, "Boy, you know that guy's neat," you know, and it's safe. It's a satanic pride at that time. But it's a beautiful passage, right?
Near the end.
It's at the beginning. It's one of the things, and then it's sort of when he. You know, he believed, and then he sort of split from a...
Oh, where they joined the little society of friends whose purpose in life is to be so holy?
No. Uh-huh. I think that was... So how does it go? Something popped into my mind. Does Zhivago hold his breath until his face turns blue? In a sense, does Vipassha is getting back at history in an active sense? Is Zhivago getting back at history in a negative sense? Mm-hmm. I'm going to hold my breath until I... until it's over, and then he suffocates. Did he need the air of Laura to make up for this thing that was happening to him? The reaction against the... I can't find this.
Yeah, that's one thing I've always been interested in terms of this novel. What is it that does kill him? What kills Zhivago? What do you think?
The disease that he's died of?
Yeah. What causes, you know? There's something in this novel to the extent of it that's very contemporary now. Diseases are brought on by our, you know, our lifestyle, what we are. And it's more than once that you have this thing that says, you know, moral duplicity brings on heart attacks.
Remember, he was the ace diagnostician,
right,
of the
hospital. The doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the part in the where he's in the apartment in Moscow in the end where he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I have to leave now. I need some air." So the window's open.
Mm.
Oh, it's always that with the windows. Remember, he's in that old office trying to get that window open. Even in during the war years, it's stuck, you know, he's banging on this thing. It's puttied shut. Because it's kind of crunching, you know. It's almost pinching at the throat, you know, you get this impression you read this work. Well, what kills this guy? For me, it's always been this kind of thing, moral, in a sense, a moral duplicity. But I can't really phrase it well.
Yeah, what do you mean by moral duplicity?
Well, I'm not quite sure what I mean by that either. I like the phrase. In a sense, it's that here is the guy who says this, who does this.
Yeah.
You know?
He does exactly the opposite of what he
says. Not necessarily the opposite,
well,
but who is himself very torn up by the problems of... I mean, what must occur to him more than once is, why am I alive here at all?
part that lives through this or all my dreams.
Mm-hmm. But did I sacrifice part of myself to remain alive this long?
Yeah.
What did I give up, or have I?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something of, you know, then the questions of the three wives
mm-hmm.
come in. And,
dying to yourself so that you can really truly live?
Is it worth it? Well, from, like, if he's asking the question that I give something up to live this long, is it, would I have been better off to die and still have it all back the time before?
He faced death a couple times.
Is this a worse death now, where I am now?
Oh.
Not the physical dying, but
existing.
And not, he's had life, but he hasn't been living in a span of time.
Does he see that though?
I don't know. That's,
I would think that if he could see that, that would change things, and that could change things and make it a possible resurrection instead of.
Well, there's been.
He's got
the living and the right kind of living and survival, which he sees the people around him just trying to survive. And he has all this education and he's diagnosing the problem, the ills of the country. And but he gets to the point where he's just surviving too.
And where his only act of freedom is to say that every age idealizes its bondage.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you live in it, you know. What do the Russians call it? The spiritual ceiling of the age. Our freedom, it's this passage. Men who are not free, he thought, always idealize their bondage. So it was in the Middle Ages, and later the Jesuits always exploited this human trait. Think of the Grand Inquisitor in that time.
Mm-hmm.
Zhivago could not bear the political mysticism of the Soviet intelligentsia, though it was the very thing where they regarded as their highest achievement.
The ceiling, even to put that in there, the ceiling of freedom.
Yeah.
And that seems to cut it up. Well, it doesn't allow.
Wasn't the window up? Wasn't it a high window and they put the ceiling in across?
Yeah, if you look in, you'd see their legs. No, it was a really high one, and then they put another floor.
They put a ceiling so that
they have another room above.
Yeah, so there's this little window here.
Yeah.
Lower the ceilings.
Oh.
So no
air. It makes it even harder in a sense when you think back on the kinds of things you were talking about earlier. You know, if you have difficulty, I know, I was in a course this fall where I was very reassured by a teacher, as a course on the large Elizabethan poem called The Fairy Queen, where the teacher said, "No, if you really feel stuck on this topic, you know, don't start accusing yourself, you know, unless you really haven't given it a moment's passing fancy. But it's, the subject matter is very difficult. You know, we were talking about the meaning of life. That was all kind of nice, you know, but where is it? And what does that mean? What's life even? You know, I mean, you get into these kinds of questions. And how he even robs you of kind of our historical sense. Because what does he say the revolution was? A sigh that was suppressed too long. What? Oh, no, no, no. The revolution was a result of this and this and this. And so marched this, that, right? No. Revolution was a sigh suppressed too long. You have, and what, there's this other great thing. It's petty to explore causes of titanic events. They haven't any. It's only in family quarrels that you look for beginnings. After people have pulled each other's hair out and smashed the dishes, they rack their brains trying to figure out who started it. What is truly great is without beginning, like the universe. It confronts us as suddenly as if it had always been there or had dropped out of the blue. I was thinking that comes to what John said. Yeah. And you have these two characters, you know. You get the sense from Zhivago, though we are present. You know, one of the recurring themes in the book in that regard is the words of the psalm. What are they singing at the grave? You know, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. What is Laura singing in church? The earth is the Lord's and the fullness is of. What are they singing at the house opposite the sculpture? The same song. The psalm recurs many, many times.
The 91st psalm?
It's in those late ones.
Where also where that boy that Dr. Zhivago kills, or I don't know if he kills him or not, but around his neck is that...
Yeah, amulet.
Contain that.
Yes, which says, right?
Where it's really corrupted.
And the fullness
of the Lord.
Where is that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
the devil's one, too. That's where he takes one of the temptations from, isn't it? It's on Psalm 91.
Bow down and I will give you the earth and all the fullness thereof.
Is that the one?
Yeah.
Mm. There's something, at one point, everybody in the book, except Lara and Zhivago, they see the work, you know, the revolution takes place, and they become actors. Everybody takes parts, become actors in this big drama. Except Zhivago and Lara. And...
whose politics we never know.
Yeah.
Not even a hint.
And he refused. He did consciously refuse to act. And
yet they did all that research. Like he went to the libraries and Laura did caught up on all the political stuff that was.
But makes no comment.
They never made any comment on all the.
You do have Zhivago's comment, you know, of his dislike for the impersonalness. You know, when you think in terms of that of the Kierkegaard's statement that nothing is so offensive to God as the impersonal, as the official, you know, as officialdom, as bureaucracy, because nothing is so impersonal, nothing so immediately denies you as an individual. You know.
That's the way it is in Russian, you know, even today.
He says,
state.
He actually says somewhere, I don't want to be in this play. Somewhere along the line, I don't want to be in this play.
It's almost like then that his life has been spent without any purpose.
I mean, does he have the sovereignty of one idea that, say, Alyosha had in Karamazov? And he falls down to the earth and then rises. You know, there's this kind of a sovereignty of one idea. Purity of heart is to will one thing. That's a Kierkegaard, name of one of Kierkegaard's books. That's also madness. Willing one thing isn't necessarily purity, you know, purity of heart. But in some, you know, it makes the religious man, it also makes the maniac. And the Strelnikov's face becoming like an idea. And he did. You know, during that period, sovereignty of one idea, in the negative sense. But Zhivago doesn't really do it. He doesn't even write poems. This is that when I say that about the time when I was at a certain stage of my life and I didn't write. Somebody says write, I wrote. There was a poem, you know. He didn't write. Laura had, you know, Laura within saying you should write. It's okay. He sits down, he writes his poem. He just quit doing it. He's not, he, you know, not the... Uh, not the actor. Two of the most beautiful scenes are that, and it's repeated by Lara at the end when he's in the coffin, is when she bends over and then the hair comes, you know, her hair comes down over him, and he's like this little unconscious, you know. The two places it happens, once is when they meet, you know, he comes into her place, and then she's over him like this, and he's talked of as a child, and that's used in the mother, I guess, earlier, and then
that happened when he was sick too.
Yeah, that's what I meant to know from the time at her house. Do you have two people who are saying it's? What do you think? Lara growing up too early. Would you say Dr. Shibago didn't grow up? This book is poetry is a trap for meditation, and this book is certainly a trap for meditation. It's asking questions like this. What we may have here is a 500 or 430 page poem. Did he write another novel? I think this is it.
Yeah, there's a couple unfinished plays, and there's another shorter novel. I can't remember its name.
Okay, and in Russian, what's this like?
Say
that now.
It's like blank verse. You know, you have long passages of internal rhymes, no endings, but really amazing. Very carefully thought out. And full of content. Remember, this is one of his big things. The content must always proceed. Remember when he's at Varikino, where he's mentioning his theories on art. You know, that the purpose of poetry, as he sees it, is to give out meaning, not merely to be beautiful. Then he has the little comic parody on the train when he's coming back from the First World War with the man who can't speak, but who can make noises, kind of. Who is himself funny and beautiful, but who is not able to give any content. You know, almost a pun on the art of writing. But you do get, you know, like some of these descriptions are just, woo, how someone can give you this impression. Like this one has always been my favorite. The very beginning of the book, when they're on the train. There was a faint stench from the lavatories, not quite dispelled by eau de cologne, and a smell of fried chicken, a little high and wrapped in dirty wax paper. As though nothing had happened, graying Petersburg ladies with creaking, chesty voices turned into gypsies by the combination of soot and cosmetics, powdered their faces and wiped their fingers on their handkerchiefs. When they passed the door of the Gordon's compartment, adjusting their shawls and anxious about their appearance, even while squeezing themselves through the narrow corridor, with their pursed lips seemed to Misha to hiss, "Aren't we sensitive? We're something special. We're intellectuals. It's too much for us." Fried chicken mixed with eau de cologne and lavatories.
It's like a bus.
Yes.
On a bus.
I mean, that's the...
It looks like oranges.
But the question is, me, that John said, was whether or not Shivago ever grew up. Remember what he's described as when he jumps up onto his father's grave, right? I thought he might change into a wolfhound all of a sudden. howl the way he sticks his neck out. And there's wolves are around here. Who, you know, is particularly the wolf in this book? You know, what character? Komarovsky. And notice that the wolves literally herald his appearance at Varikino. Goes outside, the wolves howl, whammo, there he is. He leaves, the wolves howl. Looks like he's going back to his family. His dog is always sitting there.
He's even seen in one part in the book with a man called Sataniti, which in Russian is Satan, telling dirty jokes with the devil. It's nice when you have a really honestly terrible character in a book. Especially in a book like this one, in which you have still the whole problem of... of how do you maintain your integrity in the world. What are the things that shape you? I remember a comment of Elise's last year, where she really got a new handle on the idea of St. Paul, where he says, those things which are good, which are beautiful, which are true, which are honest, you know, do these, you know. Look to these things. And we hear that, you know, and we go, yeah, sure, this is some kind of Renaissance humanism here, and I don't want any of that. What do you mean, the good, the true, the beautiful, do these? Yeah, when you think of the things that influence you, those are they. You know? Do you go in for half-truths, you know? You go in for what he calls the glittering phrase. See, the whole purpose of the lifestyle program is I've always seen it, and this year I was thinking about the people who are up here in it, just in terms of an idea that came to me that I used in Matins said one morning, that not all frogs which speak are really charmed princes. Some are only talking frogs. See, and the trick is to know whether or not it's a charmed prince or a talking frog, and that's the trick in this book, too, see. This is what he's continually confronted with. I mean, the revolution looks really appealing. Really does. Look at what their promises were. But you know where he stands from the very beginning. What is the reason the book gets in trouble, of course, is because you have him making fun of the revolution. That this was not orderly and planned. Even the thing before the Sventitsky's Christmas party, where they're all walking down the street and gives a description of the political meeting, which is hilarious. You had a bunch of people, and the one who they understood the least is the one who got the most applause. Then it said, and then he gives these little asides, where he's sticking his pins in, where he says, and throughout the conversation, everyone roared with applause, failing to hear the little cries for help and little cries of murder as people were being stabbed to death. You give yourself over. I mean, the miracle, mystery, and authority are in here too. And he comes from that whole long tradition, and I really think they're present.
Here you go. Five minutes now. Make your last statement.
Well, I guess, you know, just honestly, in terms of what I think about this book now, I'm more at a loss at it. See, when John asked me to do it, I've been going through some rethinking about it myself. And so a lot of the things that I once felt very concrete about this book, this is this, 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 I know what this means, whammo. You know, and I had put, shaped Dr. Zhivago into exactly what I considered him to be. Now I'm thinking it over again in terms of some other ideas. One is it so broad that it in effect says really nothing? And does it sort of do to us what One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest does, see? There you have a movie that, what, you know, or for me, you know, punches me and says, did you feel that? What am I going to say? Sure, I felt that. Well, goodbye. Well, I can't accept that. You got to tell me something. Does this really tell me something? I'm very suspicious of my own feeling towards it in terms of thinking, that was really beautiful. Which it is. I mean, it just is a beautiful story. And the second time it's better. And the third time it's better than that. But I don't know. Is it so broad that it ends by saying very little? And are we generating in conversation things that may not be in the book? Okay. And those are pretty hard criticisms, and too broad really to be used as
as tools. You have to come down with something a little more. I mean, what have I learned from reading this book? That's always the acid test, and unless you use it in some sense, shoot, may as well read the Bobbsey Twins in Italy or something. Because there I know I'm not going to get anything. Why not? And so that's the stage where it is at for me now. I don't know if even that's fair, because I do feel that I've gotten specific things out of it in the past, although one of the interesting things about the book, too, is that, or any book, is that you're open to its, you know, to your new view of it at any given time, just as you, as we say, you know, we are open to the gifts of the Spirit. And a good thing about changing your mind about a book, if you do it honestly, is that it is like that. I mean, you are given certain fruits of the Spirit for a certain time, you know. If you are given one, what happens to fruit after a particular amount of time? It gets rotten. Fruits are not forever. And you leave them, and new ones are provided for you. Yeah. And the same thing happens with books. It comes to you, and you're, this is great, you know. Then you either find out, yes, it is great, and you have more and sounder reasons than you had originally, or found out, gee, I was really wrong about that. And so I'm picking. I really am.
That really ties in with what you said at the beginning about the point of view, and not if you can't let go of it, then that's showing the lack of humility.
Yeah. Well, the thing Shivago says. Yeah, Shivago is this. Karamazov is this. There you do have a little more sound basis. Dostoevsky is very straightforward, you know, in a more straightforward sense, I think, than this. Not that he's less rich as a result. That's for sure.
Say something in defense, maybe in defense. I'd say, for those of you who finished the book, for the women who finished the book, do you know any man better than you know Dr. Shivago? Now these are very ambivalent characters, but do you know any man? Can you confidently say that you know any man better than you know Dr. Shivago? Can you with any, I mean, can you, these are ambivalent characters. Can you, with any kind of surety, say that you know any woman better than you know Laura?
That's a good question.
Perhaps you know Laura better than any other woman that you've ever met, and women, you, and also men. I mean, you know, this isn't just, you know, sexual, you know, the opposite. But and if you are me, might be tempted to say that. Is that a greatness that this book may have? In a sense, in Brothers Karamazov, I had to put all the characters together, like a personality split out into the brothers and the father. And then to know a person, I had to put them together again. And I put them together in me. I mean, you know, these are all parts of me. Mm-hmm. Here, I see a man like I've never seen a man before, and I see a woman like I've never seen a woman before. Mm-hmm. They're ambivalent characters, and yet I know them. Mm-hmm. Would recognize them from, you know, a quarter of a mile.
But remember too what he says. Remember when Shivago talks about the type of writing style that he wants to get. Mm-hmm. He says, what I really strive after is that with all its content, everything I might say might be completely, all my ideas might be completely carried over into the work in such a way that the reader will instantly scoop them all up and have them with no barriers, you know, to the understanding of his work himself as a poet, the character's work. And one of the, and in light of what John says, you know, one of the frightening things about this book is that you do have that in a sense.
I mean, I am just as confused as he is, you know, in a certain fashion. You know. You're this guy who doesn't know what to do. Yeah. And I am so thoroughly familiar with him that there is that thing about not calling him into question almost. You know. And just of an identity that's so strong and so deep with them. Even in that beautiful passage on love too. Oh, he talks about the beauty of their love for each other. I used to think that was sort of corny. I thought, gee, I've known that. You know? But it really is nice. Oh, where is that one? Remember that? Where he's, I mean, what does he do when Laura leaves? Oh, there it is. All he does is drink vodka and write poems that he can't finish. They loved each other, not driven by necessity, by the blaze of passion, often falsely ascribed to love. They loved each other because everything around them willed it. The trees and the clouds and the sky over their heads and the earth under their feet. Perhaps their surrounding world, the strangers they met in the street, the wide expanses they saw on their walks, the rooms in which they lived or met, took more delight in their love than they themselves did. That was just what had united them and had made them so akin. Never, never, even in moments of richest and wildest happiness, were they unaware of a sublime joy in the total design of the universe, a feeling that they themselves were a part of the whole, an element in the beauty of the cosmos. And I have a feeling there that this is one of those places where the translation is bad. I mean, it's nice, but it just has a little smack of Cahil Gibran in there. That always kind of, I just, take it away, you know. I don't want to hear about that. Because I can't believe that the prose style would suddenly shift like that at this point. You know, they say if you have the translator has to be as great as an author as the, what's that Italian phrase? Translator. All translators are traitors.
Something that the people in medieval tutorials, and you might click on this passage too, this beautiful passage of the love here, and what Mary was saying about the adultery of the woman who was married to the hunchback, and the way it was described in Dante. You know, there's some really odd, everything will. Everything willed it. Well, the bell rang.
Yeah.
Got it.